All right, in our study this morning, if you would please open your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 19. 2 Kings chapter 19. The accounts that we're studying have to do with the period of time involving King Hezekiah. And we've studied that from the 18th chapter. And we've noted there that King Hezekiah has been threatened in chapters 18 and 19 by the king of Assyria to conquer the city of Jerusalem. We know that the fortified cities of Judah have been taken, but the city of Jerusalem, the capital city, has not been taken. And we've noted how that Rabshakeh, the field commander or the captain of the army of the king of Assyria, has basically made fun of Hezekiah and made fun of God, saying, "You just as well surrender. All these other places, their gods could not deliver them, and what makes you think your God can deliver you?" And Hezekiah would not surrender, and he turned his argument then to the people on the wall of the city of Jerusalem, a very loose paraphrase, essentially telling them, "You need to talk to your king, he's going to get you all killed." And Hezekiah had instructed them to answer him not a word. And they did not. And we find then that when he got up in the morning to charge on the city of Jerusalem, 185,000 of his soldiers had been smitten by an angel in the night. And, of course, they were dead. And Jerusalem was delivered. Now, this map that you have before you is one that I want you to really remember. Because in my study, at least, it's been very helpful, not only in my own personal studies, but in my efforts to try to teach God's Word and help people to be impressed with what God's Word says. Here's Judah on this map, and we see that the king of Assyria has traveled from Nineveh. Look at what he ultimately conquered all the way down into Egypt, but there's Judah. Now, what was the rule that God had given unto his people? Isn't that simple? Now, I want this to be well understood. Someone called this to my attention, and frankly, I don't remember who, that when we establish that rule, I'm not suggesting that today, if you become a Christian, you'll have prosperity. That's not the point. But the blessings of God would be upon his people. They would be spared. They would have the things that they needed. They would not be taken captive by other nations if they would obey God. But if they worshipped and served idols, what would ultimately happen to them? They would be taken captive. Now, that was the very thing that Moses had told them a number of times. Deuteronomy chapter 4, chapter 8, chapters 28 through 30, that if you worship and serve other gods, God will destroy you out of this good land. In other words, you'll be taken captive. We note that Joshua had told them the same thing in Joshua chapter 23. And this has been a repeated lesson to them. During the period of the judges, they saw that illustrated. When they were faithful to God, God blessed them. And when they worshipped and served idols, God raised up opposition to them, and they were defeated. And when they returned to God, God would provide for them a judge or a deliverer. And once again, then when they would be faithful, they would prosper. Now that's the rule, and we've seen that repeated throughout their history. Now one of the things that ought to be impressive to us on this map is, where is Israel? We've studied in 2 Kings chapter 17 regarding the period of the northern kingdom, how that the king of Assyria has conquered them and taken them captive. And now here we are down the pike a few years, and Judah being threatened by the king of Assyria. But he's remaining, Hezekiah, remaining faithful to the Lord, and Judah is spared. Now, I don't have the next map in sequence here, but if we show the next map, which we will get to down the pike just a little bit, we'll see how that Assyria is gone, and Babylon is present. And you'll note that Judah is gone. And it's because years later, after the reign of King Hezekiah,
they also began to worship and serve idols, and God raised up the Babylonians and destroyed them and took them captive. Now, one of the things I want you to remember also in this study is that we're not talking about 100% of the citizens of either Israel or Judah engaging in the worship of idols. You recall that when the prophet Elijah was rebuking those who were worshiping the idol Baal, that and posed for them the question, if Jehovah be God, serve him. If Baal be God, serve him. And he challenged them to the contest. And then he slew all the prophets of Baal. And then Jezebel vowed that tomorrow, by this time, your life will be like one of them. In other words, I'm going to kill you by this time tomorrow. We note that Elijah fled and hid in a cave. And he thought he was all alone. But God reminded him that no, there are yet 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. But the point being, even though there were 7,000, they constituted a remnant. The gist of the people of Israel had worshipped the idol Baal. And consequently, we see them in 2 Kings chapter 17, Samaria fell to the king of Assyria. Now, again, we note here that Judah is standing. And the reason is Hezekiah's faithfulness in leading these people to serve the Lord. Now, in our next chart, well, I'm not ready to talk about all of that, but we'll introduce it just here. We'll talk about the conclusion of Hezekiah's life before we talk about Manasseh, Hezekiah's son. But I want to note just here that the next chart, I believe it is. Yes, Hezekiah became ill. This gets us down into chapter 20. Chapter 20. This is where we left off in our last study as we talked about Hezekiah appealing to God on the basis of the things that he did, the reforms and so forth.
Before you get that far, I just thought it was very interesting in Chronicles when you read about when Hezekiah reinstituted the Passover, and part of what he said to the people was, if you would obey him, God would even tell the rulers of the country where those people were held captive and be kind to them and let them come back.
Is that impressive?
He tried to convince them.
It is. That's impressive. Hezekiah tried in every way, in that way, to get the people to serve the Lord. And they wouldn't do it. Now, tell me, what can you do from that standpoint? David, I know in your class you're beyond this, but what can you do if you're in the position of Hezekiah to cause people to do right?
Well, you could first of all set the example of doing right, which he was doing. But start enforcing the laws that are in place, and the laws that the Bible, at that time, the laws of the land was the law of God, so he started enforcing the laws that, that they weren't obeying at that time.
Okay, let me ask you, the class as a whole, not just you, but let me ask the class as a whole, have you ever wondered what you could do to be more effective in trying to convert people to obey the Lord? That thought ever crossed your mind? Well, you ever think, well, I'll get a baseball bat and I'll run up and down the street and I'll just whack folks that don't obey the Lord and I'll drive them. You can't do that. What's the greatest tool that you have? The power of persuasion. All you can do is try to persuade. And that's where Hezekiah is. You can't browbeat people to make them obey the Lord. Which, you know, you might find that to be a desirable thing, but you can't do that. This is something that the Lord desires us to want. Yes, that's true. Very good. Yeah, that's been tried, and that didn't work either. And so that just is not the plan. But Hezekiah became ill, and he told the Lord of the things that he had done, and his life was extended for 15 years. And want to note that at the conclusion of that, the king of Babylon has heard that Hezekiah is sick and is now well, and so he sends emissaries to visit Hezekiah, and if you'll note in verse 13, Hezekiah showed them all that was in his house, all his precious things. This is 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 13. 2 Kings 20, verse 13. He showed them all that was in his house, his silver, his gold, his spices, the precious oil, the house of armor.
and all that was found in his treasuries, that there was nothing in his house, nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not. Now, we've noted that running parallel to this time, we read in the prophecy of Isaiah, who prophesied during this time, as we see in this very context. The prophet Isaiah, verse 14, came to Hezekiah, and he asked him, what have you shown them? What have they seen in your house? Verse 15. And Hezekiah said, all that is in my house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. Well, was that good or bad? Very bad. Hezekiah has showed them everything. Now, Isaiah points out to him that the day will come when everything that you've showed them will be taken by Babylon. Now, what's he telling Hezekiah? Hezekiah, very good king, but he erred here. But what's he telling Hezekiah? What about this kingdom of Judah that we saw on this map back here? Somewhere. There it is. What about the kingdom of Judah? It's going to be conquered. Who's going to conquer it? The Babylonians are going to conquer it. They're going to take everything you've got, Hezekiah. Now, it won't be in your lifetime, but they will take everything that you've got. And so Hezekiah has made a very tragic mistake here in showing them all that was in his house. Now, understanding that, this king, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, we've talked about him, we've talked about his bold threat, and we've talked about what was prophesied unto him in the events in verse 36 and 37 of the previous chapter. Isaiah tells us a little bit more about it, how that when he went home, his sons killed him, just as he was told would ultimately happen to him. Now, let's talk a little bit about Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah. Well, one other point. I want you to mark this in your mind. When we think about division points in the kings, just a rule to kind of help you remember where you are when you're studying, you think of the United Kingdom. What kings do you think about?
Saul, David, and Solomon.
That's right. When you think about the division of the kingdom, of course, you think about Rehoboam and the foolishness that he employed, the son of Solomon, that divided the kingdom. Then from Jeroboam to Hoshea in the northern kingdom, that is a benchmark. None of the kings of Israel were good kings. Every one of them served idols, from Jeroboam to Hoshea. But what happened during the reign of Hoshea? They were taken into Assyrian captivity. Who's king now in Judah when that occurs? Hezekiah. Alright? So this is a benchmark. Hezekiah on until the end then of the kings in the south, the southern kingdom, until they're taken captive about 586 BC by the Babylonians. So I want you to fix that in your mind. Benchmarks of the period of the kings, so that you can know about when you're studying. Now, in our study just now, we want to talk about Hezekiah's son, Manasseh. Carolyn, good king or bad king?
Bad
king.
Before we go on to Manasseh.
All right, I'll just take that right back.
Since this is a study of history and geography, I think it's important to note a very impressive thing that Hezekiah did, as pointed out in 2 Chronicles 32 and in verse 30. It only gets one verse here in the Bible, but in archaeological history, it's gotten a lot of press. Is that Hezekiah stopped up the water spring up at the Gihon spring and made it go underground into the city of Jerusalem, so that when they were besieged, they would always have water available to them.
Very good point. And the discovery of that is relatively recent, if I recall.
50s or 60s.
Yeah. The reason I say that, I saw a documentary on the television back some time ago about that, and it was quite interesting. And yes, it was something that you could almost stand in places you could stand up in,
right,
yea wide or so forth, and would carry a considerable amount of water. Was square, as I recall.
The people that discovered it, crawled in, several feet deep mud all the way up to find out what its origin was.
Yeah. That's interesting.
What verse is that? 2 Chronicles 32, 31.
32 what? No, 32:30. Yeah. Make a note of that. That's an excellent point. I had not thought to make that point. Very good. Very good. Now, one of the things that is an interesting observation, too, when you think about kings and fortified walls around cities and that sort of thing, that became very crucial, water supply. In fact, as I recall, the city of Babylon was built on the Euphrates River. And when Babylon was destroyed, Cyrus, the king of the Medes, or king of the Persians, rather, diverted the whole Euphrates River around the city and just marched up the riverbed and took the city. So water supplies became very crucial to whether or not a city lived or died.
Yeah, this is touched on peripherally in 2 Kings, where it mentions something about shall the enemies have water or something like that. And this sort of goes on somewhere else then, but that's where Hezekiah got the idea.
Yeah.
The water's all available to them, not to us.
Yeah. Excellent point. I appreciate you bringing that up. Excellent point. Very good. Any other comments or questions before we go on to talk about Manasseh? Manasseh, pardon me? You want to go back one more time? Okay. Manasseh. All right. As Carolyn pointed out, Manasseh was a very evil king. Now, we can read the account in the Kings, but I want to pick up some thoughts from the Chronicles while you're over there to that opening in 2 Chronicles chapter 33. In 2 Chronicles chapter 32, in verse 33, we read of the death of Hezekiah and how that he was buried in the sepulcher of the fathers, the sons of David. And all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem did him honor at his death, and Manasseh his son reigned in his stead. Look at verse 1 of 33. It says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah after the abomination of the nations whom Jehovah cast out before the children of Israel. Now, the history of the kings. Some might look at this and say, well, that's boring. I don't like studying about that. And we've talked about that before. But to me, it's an exciting period of Old Testament history. One, because of things that Richard has pointed out. But two, when we look at the reign of Manasseh, look at what a good father he had. Look at all the reforms that he made. But now look at Manasseh. How do you explain that? Here you've got a wonderful man for the most part, but you've got one of the worst kings of Judah being his son. David?
Well, his son didn't come along until after that added time that God gave him. And in that added time, we see his pridefulness with the Babylonians, showing them all the treasures and stuff. So when his son came along, it was actually after he had started kind of messing up.
Okay.
So the example the son got was not the earlier Hezekiah that we know that was faithful to God.
Okay. One of the things we've already learned in previous studies is that we have not. That's in Esther. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But making the observation in passing is the text has repeatedly said the works of this man, they're recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings. And then we read about King Artaxerxes in the book of Esther. Or was it Xerxes? Richard, help me on that. I get those two confused. In the book of Esther, couldn't sleep one night, and he got the book of the Chronicles out and was reading about the kings. And when you accept that there was such a book, they had history books too, to tell them what king did what and whether it was good or bad and the consequences that followed or the blessing that followed, you still have this question about Manasseh. Yes, he came along late in the life of
of Hezekiah, but he reigned for 55 years. Would you think it'd ever be a good thing to pick up the Chronicles and read about them? Now, we know that Manasseh, later on, he made some changes. Some changes for good. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But look at some of the bad things that he did. Beginning in verse 3, it says, he built again the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down. And he reared up altars for the Baalim and made Ashereth and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of Jehovah. What's that mean? He built altars in the house of the Lord. That's right. He turned the temple into a place to worship idols. Well, God not very happy with him. And you'll notice in verse 4, as it continues, whereof Jehovah said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. Manasseh's messing up just big time. He's reintroduced the practice of idol worship. Verse 5, he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of God. He also made his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. And he practiced augury and used enchantments and practiced sorcery and dealt with them that had familiar spirits and with wizards. He wrought much evil in the sight of Jehovah to provoke him to anger. Well, let's pause there. Maybe the word augury is not a word we use very much, but the idea is that he took signs from birds. That's intelligent. All right, Randy, and then Richard, please.
New American Standard reads, he made his sons pass through the fire of the valley of Ben-Hinnom. He practiced witchcraft, used divination, practiced sorcery, and dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger.
Okay, that's what he did.
Ahasuerus.
Okay.
Then Esther.
Okay. I wonder, where is he coming from? Ahasuerus. All right. Yeah, Artaxerxes and Ahasuerus was the same man. Yeah, okay. I didn't remember Ahasuerus, but particularly, but I knew it was one or the other, Xerxes or Artaxerxes. But look at the things that he was doing. He burned his sons in the fire. Underscore that. You know, everybody here, for the most part, you have children. Can you imagine taking your sons or daughters and casting them upon a red hot skillet, so to speak, in worship to an idol? That's what they did. And that's what Manasseh is doing with his sons. Just makes you shake your head and say, what a nut to do such foolish things in worship to an idol. Now, we've studied, Randy, recently about what it means to worship an idol. What is that thing? Psalms 115. It's a man-made object. You know, it has eyes, but it can't see. It has hands, but it can't do anything. It has feet, but it can't go anywhere. It has a mouth, but it can't say a word. And you're going to fall down before that thing and worship it. Now, that's what Manasseh is doing. Even casting his children before it to be burned alive as an act of worship to that God. How do you do that? How do you imagine such insanity to do such a thing? Well, Isaiah, during this period, illustrates it by saying, here's a man who is a blacksmith, and he forges an axe, and a man takes the axe, and he goes into the woods, and he cuts down a tree, and from the tree he builds a fire, and from the fire he cooks flesh to feed himself, and then from the fire he warms himself, and then he carves out of the same tree an idol and calls it his God and bows down before it and worships it. When you read that in Isaiah chapter 44, you just shake your head. How can you imagine such ignorance? But that's what it was. David?
I give a little bit of an answer. I can't truly answer it in full because it's just too... It still remains the same question, how you do that. But... Ezekiel 18, chapter verse 20, each person shall be responsible for their own sin. And I don't mean to sound really trite, but try wise person will sometimes, their offspring have a mind of their own, and for whatever reason, they're going to go the way of the world, even though it's dry with, you know, and that's what it seems like.
We make our own decisions. That's right. And though the children of Israel are called the children of God, this is what they're doing. They were God's children, but these are the things they're doing. Randy and then John.
It's a natural consequence of their failure to completely demolish all the nations that they conquered originally.
Well, that's true. Here's the influence of these nations that they've left among them.
Because Manasseh is not coming up with some new idea. These are gods that have been there for years, and man-made objects and man-made and practice. You know, the practice of passing their children through the fire. That's something that Moses had warned them about.
Right.
And this is what they're doing in the nation that we're about to take.
Their knowledge of Molech might not have existed if they had driven all these people out.
Right. And the other thing is, I just wanted to say really what the only explanation that makes any sense is that Satan's really good at what he does.
He is indeed.
Because it's deception. He's mastered the art of deception, and he deceives people into thinking that these idols are actual gods.
Yeah, a lot to be said on that, but that's right. John?
So the other thing between Manasseh and Dad, you know, Hezekiah, how his dad could be such a good person and ask about so much is, I didn't get the impression, especially back then with the kings, they didn't spend a whole lot of time with their children, right? It seems like he left that to a servant or their mom or someone else. You know, we have the same thing today with people who are so driven by their career, you know, that they don't have time for their children. So
yes.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of correlation between the father and the son. I think that's a lot.
Strange you would say that. Timely, I guess I should say. I was just reading an article about a man and his wife. They didn't have much of this world's goods, but they were happy, it seemed, and they had children, and everything seemed to be going well. And they thought it would be nice to have a little extra income, so things began to develop where both of them were working, and then they had to hire a nanny to take care of the children, and then the children became rebellious to mom and dad, and yet would listen to the nanny, and mom and dad were losing control, and nothing seemed to be going right. And bottom line is they had pursued things to the extent that they had to go back to the time when they virtually didn't have anything to find the happiness that they had left. But they did. They realized what they had done, the mistake they had made, and got things back in order and focused on their priorities. But sometimes we make that mistake. And I think that's what you're seeing here. Now, we know the point is true, John, because when we studied about Ahab, we saw that Ahab, you remember, had 70 sons that Jehu killed. But he went to the city where notable men had raised the 70 sons of Ahab. They weren't really in Ahab's house. Excellent. Anything else? All right, well, let's look just a little further in our study. In 2 Kings chapter 21, we're not through here, so leave your marker here. But in 2 Kings chapter 21, in verse 16, the writer tells us that Manasseh filled Jerusalem with innocent blood. Now, the focus, I think, we need to see on that is those who were innocent were likely the children. And he's filling Jerusalem with the blood of the innocent. Now, with that thought in mind, let's go back to the account of 2 Chronicles. In 2 Chronicles chapter 33, it tells us in verse 7 that he had set the graven image of the idol which he had made in the house of God, of which God said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, will I put my name forever. Neither will I any more remove the foot of Israel from off the land, which I have appointed for your fathers, if, there's our word, if only they will observe to do all that I have commanded them, even all the law and the statutes and the ordinances given by Moses. Did you see that? Verse 8, specifically, of 2 Chronicles 33. Verse 8. I will no more move the foot of Israel from off the land if you keep my commandments. Now that's what Moses had told them all the way through. That's what Joshua told them. And now we see that's what God told them unto David and unto Solomon. How many warnings does it take to get your attention about something? That baseball bat we were talking about a while ago, is that what it takes? Point of focus. I don't know how much stronger to say that. Point of focus. When you do what God says, then God blesses. When you don't, then there are consequences. And consequences always follow. They always do. Like that big gorilla we talked about through the door back there. It's going to whack you every time you try to go through. 100% of the time. Never fails. It's going to happen. How many times you want to challenge him? You see, God has told them time and time and time again, this is exactly what's going to happen if you do this. And they're determined, we're going to do it anyway. And we're going to do it time and time and time and time again. How many times does it take you to get the point? You see, sometimes we suffer the loss of our children to get the point. When a generation passes, we're going to see that in Manasseh's case. When a generation passes, but then, of course, it's a little late to retrieve that generation. In verse 9, he continues, and Manasseh seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that they did evil more than the nations whom Jehovah destroyed before the children of Israel. Look at that, if you will. When you talk about Manasseh being an evil king in Judah, they're doing worse now than the nations that were there that they drove out. So ultimately, what do you know is bound to happen? You know it's coming. What's going to happen to them? They're going to be destroyed. They'll be taken captive. Now in verse 10 it says, and Jehovah spake unto Manasseh and to his people, but they gave no heed. There's you a lesson, Randy. They wouldn't listen. You know, when we look in the New Testament, we see the expression, take heed, and that occurs over and over and over and over and over. But here they wouldn't take heed. And we see what happened. They wouldn't listen. Now, to take heed means to do what? To listen. Yeah, you listen. But Manasseh wouldn't listen. It says, wherefore Jehovah brought upon them the captains of the hosts of the king of Assyria and took Manasseh in chains and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in distress, he besought Jehovah his God and he humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. You know, we asked the question a while ago, what does it take to get your attention? God had threatened captivity. And now we see that Manasseh, as king of Judah, is taken, and the text tells us, in his distress, he besought the Lord. But wait a minute, what about all these idols that he's been worshiping? What about the idols that he's built in the temple? And now in his distress, why don't he turn to them?
He knows they're nothing.
Well, why did he build altars to them? Yeah, but why? You know, we look at this, and several of you have noticed, we shake our head, you know, in unbelief. Can't believe he did that. But he did. But are we ever so foolish to do the same thing? Absolutely.
I think the unseen forces in here are, he's not all by himself. He's surrounded by people.
Yep.
And he's influenced by people. And that's really the answer here, is that he was, you know, 1 Corinthians 15:33, bad company corrupts good morals.
Yep.
he was hanging around the wrong people and were advising him the wrong thing.
That's right.
But apparently he still had somebody who said, you know, maybe you should entreat the Lord.
Well, these prophets had repeatedly emphasized that to him. Isaiah, for one. But yes,
he finally did.
But look at verse 13. It says, he prayed unto him, and he was entreated of him, and heard his supplications, and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that Jehovah, he was God. All right, now we've suffered the consequence over here, at least part of it. We're not done with him. And now he's found out that the rule, you do what I say and I'll bless you, and you don't do what I say and I'll curse you, that came to pass. He's worshiping idols, and now he's taken away captive. And he turns to God and beseeches God, and God returns him to Jerusalem. And now he knows that Jehovah is God. Now what's he going to do about it? Pardon me? Going to clean up things. Yes. Comes back to Jerusalem, and now it's time to clean up the mess that he's made. So what does he do? In chapter 33, pick up at verse 14. It tells us, now after this, he built an outer wall to the city of David, on the west side of Gihon, in the valley, even to the entrance of the fish gate, and he compassed Ophel about with it, and raised it up to a great height, and he put valiant captains in all the fortified cities of Judah. So what does he do? He fortifies the city, puts the wall back in place. What else does he do? In verse 15, I don't know why I have chapter 32 on there, that should be chapter 33. It says, and he took away the foreign gods and the idol out of the house of Jehovah, and all the altars that he had built in the mount of the house of Jehovah and in Jerusalem, and cast them out of the city. And he built up the altar of Jehovah, and offered thereon sacrifices of peace offerings and of thanksgiving, and commanded Judah to serve Jehovah, the God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people sacrificed still in the high places, but only unto Jehovah their God. Well, now let's ask the question. What kind of impact has Manasseh made on the people with his efforts to reform? What kind of impact has he made on the people with his efforts to reform?
Not as much as the people making his efforts to sin.
That's exactly right.
He taught them pretty well the first time around.
He did. That's right. Now, I tell you what, it's just a whole lot easier to keep folks on the right track than it is to lead them off the track and then to get them back. And that's where Manasseh is. He has learned through his being taken captive that there's only one God. So he goes about to tear down all these altars and restore worship to God. But verse 17 tells us that the people sacrifice still in the high places, but only unto Jehovah their God. What about these places where they had worshipped idols? They're still doing that. They're still going to those places, but they're worshiping God in those places. Wait a minute, where was the place of worship? In the temple, in Jerusalem. So Manasseh has convinced the people of what? Okay, goes a little beyond that, but yes. How far does it go?
Essentially, isn't he still saying that God is only one God of all the gods?
Yes, that's what the people had perceived. Now, though Manasseh may have a different understanding of that, the people are not convinced. They've just added him to the list now. Randy?
Well, he's emphasized the identity of God and not the obedience to the word.
All right.
Would have demanded obedience to his word, that they would have understood they're not going to the high places to worship anymore.
Well, sure. Yeah. That's right. Any other comment or question? This is serious business, isn't it? What Manasseh has done, and the lessons are powerful. Now, picking up the thought there at verse 18, it says, now the rest of the acts of Manasseh and his prayer unto his God, and the words of the seers that spake to him, Randy, there's your point, in the name of Jehovah, the God of Israel, behold, They are written among the acts of the kings of Israel. His prayer also, and how God was entreated of him, and all his sin and his trespass, verse 19. And the places wherein he built high places, set up the ashram and the graven images before he humbled himself. Behold, they are written in the history of Hosea. So Manasseh slept with his fathers, and they buried him in his own house, and Amon his son reigned in his stead. Not through with this point. When you think about what Manasseh did to encourage the people to worship idols, and now Manasseh's understanding is really there's one God, and he beseeches him. But the reaction of the people is to worship God in the high places of their idols, so they don't have a clear understanding of the reforms that need to take place. And consequences will follow. Yes?
Well, the very bad thing happened to Manasseh. The people kind of were on the periphery, so it didn't affect him quite so severely. So maybe they didn't have that same thing.
Perhaps.
Even though you repent, you still have to take consequences a lot of times for your form of sin. It's not you repent and you don't have consequences for things you've done in the past. If you smoke for 30 years and you quit smoking, you still have lung damage and heart damage, even though you've repented and whatever. So even though you repent, there's still consequences for earlier action. So, of course, the example you use, a lot of faith and stuff. So yeah, even though Manasseh said he humbled himself and he knew that God was, God, I think in verse 17 or 14. Mm-hmm. So he really did repent. He humbled himself. Mm-hmm. And he knew who God was. But there were still consequences to his early actions.
Yes. And that's tough. Forgiveness is not equivalent to the removal of temporal consequences. And I think sometimes we miss that point. We think we can be forgiven and everything's okay. No, not necessarily. There's still some things that we will suffer, and maybe the rest of our life, because of the decisions that we've made, and we very well may not be the only ones that suffer. Those we have impacted may suffer as well. David?
Yeah, just a different way of saying the same thing, I guess. With a lot of people, it seems like a lot of damage that was caused by Manasseh was irreversible.
Yeah.
And I guess that would be consequences to him, but to them.
Yeah. That's right. Harm is done. Yes, Larry.
If people put their God into the same plane as the rest of the idols in certain places of their life, there's an idol for everything that they did. So the heart is instead the one God controls everything instead of all the one idols that are in the different spaces of life.
That's right. Absolutely right. Now, on the point, I'm sorry, Jenny.
Well, one of the things that I think stands out a lot when you're looking through the kings and what they did and how long they had to do what they were going to do, one of the things that stands out is that you can't judge how good they were based on how long they lived or how long
right.
they ruled. Because Manasseh was not a good king, but he served significantly longer than his dad, who was a good king.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where when you're in the world and you're succeeding, your assumption is you're doing fine. If you were a king for 55 years, you would think you're doing something well. But that's not necessarily the case, just because you're in it for a long time, or somebody else was not in it for a long time, does not mean that you're doing well and they did poorly.
That's right. Now, how old was Manasseh when he became king?
22.
Do the math on that, John.
12, sorry.
Oh, he was 12. I was thinking 14, but he was 12. All right. John?
22.
55 and 12.
Yeah,
right. Be about 67. How many in this audience, well, besides you high schoolers, consider 67 really all that old? Randy does. Okay. Couldn't resist. Go ahead.
That's not what I meant when I was.
Sure. You know, sign of age is forgetfulness.
I've heard. Okay. I've heard.
Jenny makes a really good point. There's, it's just hard to understand sometimes. Because in the case of Manasseh, God was patient with it. I mean, he let him have some time to turn. And then when he finally bowed down and actually turned to God, God listened. God felt compassion. That shows the everlasting loving kindness and compassion of God.
Long suffering. Yeah.
And then I was remembering back to the place in Genesis. It just took me a couple of seconds to find it, but back in Genesis 38, Judah and Tamar, the story of Judah and Tamar. Jude, in verse 6, Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. It's just a short verse, but it's just, how evil did you have to be for God to go, oh, you're just too evil.
Yeah.
You're out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here's Manasseh, who's burning his sons in the fire, and God gave him time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a judgment I can't make.
Yeah, that's what I mean. If you can't second guess.
Yeah. When I think about the point Jenny was making about Manasseh reigning for 55 years, those of you that are younger in the class this morning, can you see where you will be 55 years from now? Do you ever have any idea of what you'll be doing 55 years from now? Or what might be in this period of time between now and 55 years down the road? You see, it's hard to determine that. Most of us, when we are quite young, especially when we are, what you say, I want to say 14, 12, Manasseh was when he became king. Can you imagine where he might have thought he would be as king 55 years down the pike? Or 45 years down the pike? We don't know exactly what point in here that he began these reforms. But the point being is a rather simple one. You don't know where you're going to be or what you're going to be doing. You can't look down the road and predict the future. And what you think may not be exactly the way that it is. And so we look at Manasseh's life and look back. Now, I want to make this point really quick. Just really quick. When you think of consequences, forgiveness not removing consequences, you think of the prodigal son, right? You think of David, right? You think of Saul of Tarsus, became the Apostle Paul. And he said in one of his defenses, if I have done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. You look at the thief on the cross. Jesus said this day, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Did he forgive him? Did he die the death of a thief? Yeah. Okay. Enough said. Thank you for your participation.